Wisconsin. And if you're just joining us, welcome. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're talking about the money today. And we are joined by Wisconsin Policy Forum's Executive Director, Rob Henken, a Wisconsin treasure, as I would like to say. The WPF provides nonpartisan, completely independent, objective research of Wisconsin and local government's most important public policy questions. And certainly there is no debate. I don't care, conservative, Republican, super liberal, progressive, democratic, independent, I hate politics types, that one of the most pressing questions facing Wisconsin, both as a state government, but also for all of our local governments, was what to do about shared revenue. Rob summarized in the last half hour that basically since the 1990s, shared revenue, in other words, that amount of income tax and sales tax collected from a municipality that goes directly to the state, that is then shared by the state with the local government, hence the term shared revenue, had been decreasing. And local governments, in large part, other than property taxes, had no ability to raise any revenues of their own, and property taxes were limited by effectively new construction. And so many, many jurisdictions, especially the largest seven cities in the state, found themselves in a place where it was costing more to provide the basic public services that local governments provide, especially public safety services, fire and police. Those costs were going up and going up quite rapidly. But because the shared revenue given to them by the state, collected from their own taxpayers, was actually going down because it didn't even keep up with inflation, led us to this, what the heck are we going to do? We can't fund local government. And that's where we found ourselves a number of years ago, but the issue really started to come to a head with some progress happening at the beginning of 2023. Have I summarized this correctly thus far, more or less, Rob?
You have, Maggie. Just the one thing I'd add is I think it really took a recognition that public safety services were in jeopardy to really move the needle on this. I think that for the better part of the last decade, local governments were doing their very best to shield public safety services from cuts and cutting elsewhere, and that was not necessarily getting as much attention in Madison. So I think it was that plus the huge fiscal cliff facing the city of Milwaukee that turned the tide.
So that's where we found ourselves at the beginning of 2023, and there was a large wellspring of businesses, business associations like the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce, both the mayor of the city of Milwaukee, Cavalier Johnson, the Milwaukee County Executive, David Crowley, but also elected executives from more right-leaning jurisdictions as well, that came together and really reached out to Speaker Voss, Senate Majority Leader LeMahieu, as well as the governor's office, and said, it's time to do something about it. And what happened next, Rob?
So there was historic legislation passed this past summer in conjunction with the two-year state budget. It's known as Wisconsin Act 12. It did several things, but most notably with regard to the subject at hand, it decided for the first time that I had mentioned earlier that the shared revenue appropriation became a budgetary appropriation over time, which abandoned this notion of revenue sharing. And that has now been reversed again. And that's really important. So what the legislation did was it said that we're still going to have this frozen piece of the program in place, about $900 million or so per year. But we're also going to layer on top of that a share that is going to ensure that the total shared revenue allocation now equates to one-fifth of the revenues that are generated by the state's 5-cent sales tax. So 1 cent of that 5-cent sales tax will now be earmarked toward the shared revenue program, which not only increased the amount available, there are some other things done. There was the end of the personal property tax exemption, which actually costs monies. But bottom line is there's a few hundred million dollars of extra shared revenue now in the pot, number one. Number two, as sales tax collections now grow from year to year, the distribution will also grow as part of the shared revenue program for local units of government.
And
was critical.
Yeah, if I just can, you began by making the distinction between the biannual appropriation, which is how local governments were being funded, and effectively a fixed shared revenue formula. And I want to just emphasize that for people who might not be up on all the nomenclature here. When something is part of an appropriation, it's an affirmative step that's taken by a governmental body in their budgetary process to say, yes, we will spend money here, as opposed to something that's enshrined in state law and is not discretionary. In other words, isn't up for debate in each biannual budget season, which is what the state of Wisconsin has. Of course, we can understand and we can certainly use what happens often with the, quote, government shutdown or debt ceiling debates that happen on the national level, that when a legislature and executive branch have to agree on an affirmative appropriation, it subjects that process to all sorts of sometimes fleeting temporary political wins and political debate. Whereas if the shared revenue formula is fixed in law, it's not subject to those cyclical political wins and political debates. That is a significant improvement, because indeed it was the fact that it had become an appropriation that effectively led to its freezing back in the 90s. It was such a political hot potato, and there was such political strife or difference of opinion that led to the freeze that led all of us, including smaller governments and rural communities, into this revenue crisis. So I just wanted to emphasize that, so people, when you hear appropriation, think everybody's got to agree to spend this money. It's not locked in.
That's exactly correct. So again, shared revenue, the notion of the word shared was no longer part of that process, but Act 12 brought it back to revenue sharing, as opposed to just, you know, it could have just been called state aid previously, because that's what it was.
So where does this solve the problem? Where does this leave Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, Green Bay, Racine, Kenosha, even some upstate counties as well? Where does this leave all of us?
So Maggie, that is a great question. And again, you almost have to go muni by muni and county by county. We just did put out a report last week that starts to look at that question. First of all, you also have to understand that this legislation, Act 12, did some other big things for the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. I won't go into all the details, but the biggest are, city of Milwaukee was authorized for the first time ever to be able to do a city sales tax of up to 2%, and that has since happened. And Milwaukee County was able to go from its existing half cent up to 0.9, so a 0.4% increase there. That has since happened. That was because of some very special circumstances that had placed both the city and county of Milwaukee in especially dire financial straits. But I think there is actually some sort of aftershock here, because I think there was an impression, and I do not want to diminish the historic nature of this and the fact that purely looking at it through a lens of municipal and county finance, this was a very, very significant piece of legislation. But there is now some real big concern among municipal leaders in particular, that there's sort of a feeling, oh, great, problem solved. Let's move on to our other big issues. And I think for many municipal governments, particularly larger ones, this was a very welcome reprieve, but they're going to find themselves in a similar situation within just a few years. And in fact, our report on the city budget last fall pointed out that whereas we thought that the city of Milwaukee would have about 2 or 3 years of breathing space of relatively firm fiscal footing, that by 2025, they're back in deficit mode.
It's incredible to think about that, that this historic legislation was only a temporary solve for the state's largest cities. And whatever you think about large cities, if you're from a rural part of Wisconsin, there, the larger cities within the state of Wisconsin are a huge part of the economic well-being of all of us as residents of Wisconsin. They are huge draws, whether you're talking about tourism in some of the larger tourist areas, huge amounts of folks that come for various retail reasons in various portions of the state and some of the jurisdictions, as well as, of course, those regions and counties and cities within the state that simply have big, huge elements of industry, whether that be manufacturing or financial services and other professional services, that really help drive and stabilize the Wisconsin economy and have contributed to a historic surplus within the Wisconsin state budget coffers. So it's incredibly a good positive sign that compromise was possible, yet challenges remain. What do you think, Rob, is contributing to these continued challenges for these larger municipalities?
I think one very important element here that has been underplayed a bit is just the challenges that the public sector faces in terms of being able to retain and recruit talent. This has always been a challenge for the public sector. We know, you know, Maggie, you were corporation counsel for Milwaukee County, and you obviously could have made a heck of a lot more money in private practice. So we know for certain types of jobs in government, this has always been a challenge. On the other hand, government offers a lot of other things besides financial benefit that can make it attractive. But in this historically tight labor market, at a time when, because of very high inflation, there's been real pressure to raise salaries at high levels, it's just that much more difficult for governments to make ends meet.
We'll be back with a couple of finishing thoughts with Rob Henken, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, talking about the funding challenges for all Wisconsin governments, especially the economic drivers of the state, the larger governments. Keep it locked, everybody. Take a couple of quick, important messages, I think including our agriculture update. During this breath that everybody's got, keep it locked, everybody. 855-75-CIVIC if you've got a question for Rob or I. 855-752-48. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. We're talking with Rob Henken, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, about the funding and sustainability of local government, not just in the largest cities, but across the state. I've always been a fan of the phrase, all politics is local, except for the fact that it denotes that local politics is particularly partisan. And I have always been of the mindset that local politics is totally apolitical. Potholes don't have a party, right? Our parks don't have a partisan affiliation. And everybody wants potholes filled and our park systems to be vibrant. And again, you were mentioning before the break that one of the challenges in government is the ability to hire folks, especially at the most technical jobs, but also the fundamental lifeguards, parks workers, all those folks. It's extremely hard to fill those positions these days. The jurisdictions that are nearby each other compete with each other for talent and staff, driving wage costs up. The one thing we never have any trouble filling, it seems to me, are the elected official seats. Now, I won't ask you about the large raises proposed for a few of the elected officials in Milwaukee County, but I think that's completely nuts, given the fact that we can't find enough lifeguards to staff the county pools for this summer season. But I digress. When we look at what's next or how do we solve this problem, what do you think the next push is? If you want to have anybody to remember something from this episode and our discussion today, Rob, what is it? What should people be asking their local officials, their state representatives, their state senators?
So I'm going to do a little bit of an about face here. I mean, I think there is still much more conversation merited about the revenue side of the equation and about ensuring that there is at least capacity for inflationary growth for local governments. But I think given the heavy lift that occurred last summer, it's also time to take a look at the expenditure side. And I can say this equally about Republicans and Democrats. There just has not been sufficient interest in my mind to look at service sharing and consolidation of government services. And so we have to look there. Everybody loves to have their own fire department and the name of their village or town or city on the fire truck. But really, there are types of services there that have become very parochial. It's very difficult to get communities to cooperate with one another. In other states, there have been both sticks and carrots provided by state government to encourage service sharing. We're starting to move in that direction here in Wisconsin, but we're still not where we hypothetically could be if we feel like it's going to require state government to prod local governments to do this. But I think that really has to be a next big step, is to ask, do we have too many units of government, or at least too many units of government providing too many types of services that could be consolidated?
I couldn't agree with you more, Rob. One of the studies from the Wisconsin Policy Forum that I frequently cite, I think, is about 3 years old. And you assessed effectively how many units of government or how many taxing authorities each person in the state of Wisconsin was part of. In other words, how many total units of government per capita? And we have one of the highest numbers of units of government per capita of any state in the nation. I think we're in the top five. What this means is that there is a likelihood, no matter where you live in the state, that we have duplication of services, that we have administrative oversight in overlapping jurisdictions. I'm not at one time doing one thing, a resident of Milwaukee County, and at the same time, separately, a resident of the city of Milwaukee. I am both a county and city resident all at the same time. And so trying to ask local governments, and again, I don't think that this is partisan. Local government officials, whether Republican or Democratic, generally bristle and push back hard on the idea of any consolidation. This is one of the reasons that people get frustrated with government. Consolidation is a form of innovation and change, and it is going to be necessary here in the state of Wisconsin. And instead of having really honest conversations about that, it seems to me that more often than not, government officials simply shy away from having that discussion, or simply brush it off and say, of course I'm essential. We would all like to think that we're needed in perpetuity in whatever our jobs are. But true leadership in government requires that really vigorous and fearless assessment of where can we do this more efficiently and effectively. And things like offices that may be well antiquated within local governments and can be combined into other offices, we've got to be looking there, which is why some of these raises that are being proposed in Milwaukee County is even more bothersome to me. Instead of looking for the efficiency and ways to consolidate and make it better, we're simply effectively expanding the bloat. I have never been one that subscribes to smaller government is always better government. I'm not a Grover Norquist fan. I think that was a poisonous concept. I'm also not bigger is better. What I am is for, does it work? Does it work efficiently? Is it sustainable? And are we meeting our promise to our taxpayers and residents? Rob, it's been a real pleasure to have you. I am so excited to talk to you. We've just over the break locked in Mr. Henkin to join the Maggie Dawn Show on March 19th. You're not going to want to miss that. Put that on your calendar. We're going to talk about educational funding, especially in Milwaukee public schools. But the discussion about the MPS referendum is really one that says a lot about public school funding statewide, especially given the expansion of charter choice and voucher programs statewide over the last 15 years. I always like to explain to people, Milwaukee is often the canary in the coal mine for the state of Wisconsin. When Milwaukee succeeds and does well, it helps lift the state. When our schools suffer, the rest of the state tends to suffer. And you will see those ripple effects or the same impacts, negative or positive, that are impacting Milwaukee in other places in the state. So Rob's going to join us on March 19th. Mark your calendars, everybody. There's no smarter person, no better equipped organization than the Wisconsin Policy Forum to help Wisconsinites understand the issues that affect each and every one of our communities. Rob, I wanted to just give you a quick moment, because you and I were kibitzing over lunch a couple of weeks ago when we were getting all this set up. And you shared with me, this ain't your first time on the radio, sir. We just have a little bit of time left. I wanted to give folks a chance to get to know Rob. What's your radio history, Rob?
Yep. Well, so my very first job out of college was working as a reporter for WCCM CGY Radio in Lawrence, Massachusetts. CGY stands for Kurt Gowdy. So this was Kurt Gowdy Broadcasting, the famed sportscaster for many years. And so I was a reporter. I covered school board meetings, city council meetings, et cetera. I always say, if there are any aspiring public policy people out there listening, best training I ever had was sitting through a three-hour school board meeting and then getting 45 seconds of airtime to summarize what happened. And so it makes you be concise and to the point, and that's a very important, good quality to have when you're dealing with public policy and writing position papers that very busy people aren't going to want to take the time to read if they're too long.
Well, my listeners are certainly saying, from Rob's lips to Maggie's ears, make it short and sweet, Mags. Thanks so much, Rob. Can't wait to have you back on the 19th. Keep it locked, everybody, because I'm going to talk about the money even more, maybe even a little bit of Donald Trump's money when we come back in this last half hour of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Thanks, Rob. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
A man like that is hard to find, but I can get him off my mind. Ain't it sad? And if he happens to be free, I bet he wouldn't fancy me. That's too bad. So I must leave. I'll have to go. I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my address. In a torn up town, no postcode envy, but every song's like gold teeth.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We just had on Wisconsin treasurer Rob Henkin, the executive director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, a vigorously nonpartisan group that analyzes the most important questions facing the state of Wisconsin and local governments. So proud and happy and appreciative to have Rob on. He helped break down for all of us the shared revenue question. We hear this term all the time. I think a lot of us didn't understand what it meant. So my thanks to Rob for helping to explain this and to explain where all local jurisdictions really are in the state of Wisconsin, to varying degrees, struggling to make ends meet. We heard from texter Carolyn from Kendall, Wisconsin. Thanks so much for listening, Carolyn. She works in a really technical position. I want to be specific. Carolyn asked from Kendall, Wisconsin, hey, this topic was really needed. Thanks for not getting into the weeds. You're welcome, Carolyn. You can thank Rob for that. You can find the entire conversation with Rob Henkin at civicmedia.us within a couple of hours of the end of my show on civicmedia.us. If you go check out the shows, you click on the Maggie Dawn Show, you can find today's episode in two parts. Rob will be there. You can listen to the whole thing. And for Rob, she asked, where would I find something related to the specific counties? In other words, some of this breakdown. If you go to WisPolicyForum.org, Carolyn, you will find that information there. We also heard from a texter, Cam from Nina. Hey, Cam, thanks for listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. Cam was explaining that she is in a very technical government job that would pay her somewhere in the ballpark of $25,000 to $50,000 a year more if she wasn't working in the government. She said that most of the leaders that she works for don't really understand that. And there tends to be a bit of consternation when it comes to paying government employees fairly. I will say this, as a former government employee that probably could have been 2 to 3 times what I was earning at the county in the private sector, here's what. Nearly all public servants that I know and that I have had the privilege to work with work damn hard every day. And they have done so over the last 20 years in an environment where more and more people want to kick them in the shins and spit in their face rather than say thank you for the tough work that they do. It ain't the civil servant. It ain't the lifetime public servant or the long-serving public servant. If you're mad at government, it ain't those people. Stop crapping on them. Hold your elected officials accountable. Do not allow the performative politics, which is the use of a platform that an elected official has simply for personal power gain or power leveraging or to get their name in the newspaper. Don't allow that. Demand that your elected officials pay those that work in government competitive wages, because the more competitive the public servants' wages are, the better the government will run. I promise you that. Ask your elected leaders to find ways to make government more efficient and effective, to consolidate, keeping the best performers, the hardest workers, the folks with the greatest level of technical acumen. That is how we will make government work better for the people. And the civil service system, which helps protect public employees from politicians who want to make technical experts and researchers and professional skill workers, and your lifeguards at the pools, your parks worker, and those people, they want to make all those sorts of people politically vulnerable, meaning if you don't agree with the guy who's at the top of the heap that just won the election, you can get fired. We don't want the loss of public service and the civil service in government. It will make government incredibly more inefficient, incredibly less effective. Carolyn, I think that's your name. Anya thinks she heard it correctly. Carolyn, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. Welcome.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, I'm thankful for the show. It brought a subject matter that just like made my eyes glaze over, okay?
I hope we didn't do that today, Carolyn.
But I couldn't keep up with the note. So I'm glad you repeated the area to go to assign it. Now, the up-and-coming show on the 19th about public school funding, another area we all glaze over. I'm expecting him to do the same, where he simplifies it. And I want to post it to my Facebook page. Is there some sort of icon you can get about that particular show?
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got people very active in southeastern Wisconsin.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks so much for calling, Carolyn. If you go to civicmedia.us, you navigate to the Maggie Dawn Show, you can find the episode for today. There is a way to share. It's the little box with the arrow that looks like it's pointing up. You can share that and just post the link to today's show on any of your social media with your commentary about it. I like to call it breaking down the complex. Let's make the complex public policy arguments accessible for all of us, because these are the things that impact us the most. That's the thing. The easy problems have all been fixed. It's only the tough stuff that remains. And people that sell you that simple line, they're lying to you. The big thorny problems that haven't yet been fixed, they don't get fixed with one-liners. They're complicated. But what I'm trying to do with folks like Rob and great callers like Carolyn and all our listeners out there, hello to the people on Facebook and YouTube watching. What we're trying to do here is take that complexity and break it down bit by bit so that every single one of us, no matter what your party affiliation is, can be the most informed voter you can be. That's how we make government work for all of us, because that's what each of us deserves. Now, I've promised to talk about the money. And I got to do that because there's a lot going on about the money these days. I wanted to start with what I think one of the most hated billionaires on the planet, Elon Musk. What a jerk. He's, you know, like the savior of the incel. I mean, that's who this guy is. Appealing.
Do people know what incels are, Maggie, or is that something?
Well, we'll explain it. Incel is shorthand for involuntarily celibate, which is also sort of coded language for the gamer type that lives in his mom's basement that never goes out and basically spews hate speech on social media.
Very big on hating women because it's all women's fault that they won't pick this charmer of a guy from the basement. That's a great boyfriend, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One that has never seen the light of day.
Right.
Iridescently glowing skin. Anyways, so I'm being a little bit glib here, but Elon Musk, I mean, from all of the organizations that measure hate speech online and have specifically looked at Twitter, after Elon Musk took over and removed basically all of the controls relating to hate speech, and I'm not talking about shut up, Maggie, that's not hate speech. I'm not talking about Maggie, you're a dummy, I disagree, or even more florid language than that. I'm not talking about that stuff. That's not hate speech. Hate speech is a violent description of what someone wants to do to me because I'm a woman and have a different opinion, or what folks want to do to Jewish folks or Muslim folks because of their religion that advocates violence and uses language of violence. That is hate speech. Uses imagery and posts imagery of the most vile and disgusting sort. That is hate speech. Elon Musk said, on the altar of the First Amendment, we have to allow everything, even the things that incite violence. That's all fine on Twitter. And indeed, what has happened since he took over Twitter? Hate speech has erupted. Let's listen to a little of the most hated billionaire on the planet. This is what he has.
I'm a big believer that people need to are more productive when they're in person. Look, there are some exceptions, but I kind of think that the whole notion of work from home is a bit like the, you know, the fake Marie Antoinette quote, let them eat cake. Mm-hmm. It's like really, you're going to work from home and you're going to make everyone else who made your car come work in the factory. You're going to make the people who make your food that gets delivered, that they can't work from home. The people that come fix your house, they can't work from home, but you can. Does that seem morally right? That's messed up.
You see it as a moral issue?
Yes.
I mean, I see it more as
it's a productivity issue, but yeah. It's also a moral issue.
Huh? It's a moral issue. Okay, so Elon often paints with an incredibly broad brush, right? I think there are really key discussions to be had about those that can work from home and those that can't. And equity and wages, it tends to be more white-collar desk workers that can work at home. And he's right to point out that there's inequities within our economic system and that many workers that have to show up to do their jobs aren't treated equitably. But guess who's done the most for those sorts of workers in the United States in modern history? Joe Biden. He has stood shoulder to shoulder with unions. Why do you think wages are now rising in excess of inflation? Because Joe Biden has helped, again, reinvigorate the union movement. When unions do better, when they negotiate for higher wages and benefits, everyone does better. Everyone. By the way, Elon Musk hates unions. So it's like, well, if it's a luxury to be able to work from home, maybe we should pay people who work on the line or make our food or deliver our products more. Not according to Elon. In other words, Elon's a bunch of baloney that he spews because he thinks it appeals to his base without ever actually meaning it. Anyways, I'm talking about the money. Talked about the fact that Elon Musk hit with a $65 billion disgorgement order a few weeks ago by the Delaware Chancery Court. Basically, he had stacked Tesla's board of directors with insiders, cronies, and friends who then gave him a $65 billion pay package. Dear Elon, why don't you give some of that to the people that are making the cars on your assembly line instead of talking about the morality of work from home? I mean, isn't it rich that somebody who thinks it's fine for him to have $65 billion is talking about morality? Letting hate speech spew off of his platform. He was just sued for $128 million by his former executives that worked at Twitter that had a contract that said, if Twitter is delisted off the stock exchange, here is the money that we get. Said it very plainly in his contract. Elon said, go piss off, in essence. Why? Here's what. Here's this Elon Musk quote. He could fire the executives, quote, for cause. He didn't. To avoid paying them severances, Mr. Musk told his biographer that he would deny the executive severance payments, saving himself about $200 million. He told Mr. Isaacson, his biographer, he would, quote, hunt the executives, quote, till the day they die, end quote. How about this as a legal strategy? Just refuse to pay what you owe to people and then litigate them into smithereens because you have a ton of money. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Troy from Mount Herb, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you?
Yeah, it's funny how he talks about free speech, but then I've done two suspensions. One because I said to Mark Wayne Mullins, I wish that Teamster guy had kicked his ass.
Good for you.
And one because somebody brought up January 6th, and I wondered, you know, and how they backed the cops. And I wondered why the cops didn't follow their use of force continuum. And, they talked about Ashley Babbitt.
Yeah, we got to take a couple messages, Troy. Yeah, if you back the badge, why were you storming the Capitol on January 6th? Why were you attacking police officers? Apparently you back the badge, except if they disagree with you, except if they're trying to do their job and you disagree with that. A little consistency might be refreshing. When we come back, I'm going to tie together the whole money theme for today, and then I'm going to give us all a ray of hope going in tomorrow, which is a huge day on the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm going to be joined at the top of the hour by Senator Tammy Baldwin to help celebrate International Women's Day. Take that, Elon. Keep listening. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royals. It's a one in our blood. That kind of love's just a freedom, freedom. I can't move. Freedom, cut me loose. Yeah. Freedom, freedom. Where are you? 'Cause I need freedom too. I break chains all by myself. Won't let my freedom ride in hell. Hey, I'ma keep on. I won't quit on you. I hope you don't quit on me. It's the big roundup, the big finale for the Maggie Dawn Show here on Thursday afternoon. So, I cannot believe the audacity of Republicans to ask Hunter Biden about Burisma. I would say it was in poor taste. He traded on his dad's name. They have absolutely no evidence that anything actually nefarious happened. The reason that I can't say I cannot believe the audacity is because Jared Kushner is cashing a $40 million check every year from Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund, months after Kushner left the White House, where he also had a cushy job on the taxpayer dime, seems to be a theme here. Saudi Arabia gave him $2 billion. And this is after Kushner defended Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, after he ordered the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And they gave him $2 billion despite the fact that the investment committee of the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund said that the Kushner investment fund was, quote, inexperienced, and, quote, the bulk of the investment and risk would be borne by the kingdom, and that the due diligence was, quote, unsatisfactory in all aspects, and that the proposed asset management fee seems excessive, end quote. And that there was a public relations risk. Yeah, they just ignored all that. I wonder why Mohammed bin Salman decided to ignore the advice of all of his expert advisors and give Kushner cut him a $40 million check. And by the way, that's before the actual investment management fee on the return, if there is any. Asked about this recently, Kushner basically said, why are we still talking about this? Stop asking me these questions. Gross. That's corruption. Let's talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia spent hundreds of thousands of dollars at Trump properties during Trump's presidency. I wonder why. And now Donald Trump may be cash broke. That's part of the good news. Maybe cash broke. Here are the judgments against Trump. $83.3 million plus $5 million. That's $85.3 million to E. Jean Carroll. $355 million plus basically $100 million in interest in the New York civil fraud trial. $100,000 for a subpoena violation. $15,000 for disparaging the clerk. $4 million times two is owed $8 million by his sons. He owes $500,000 to the New York Times for legal fees in a frivolous case. He owns basically $1 million to Hillary Clinton for filing a frivolous lawsuit. It goes on and on and on. It might all total up near about $600 million, and according to a filing in a 2021 financial statement, Trump only has about $300 million in cash, and although he is going to appeal many of these judgments, he has to post a bond for all that, which means actually turn over cash. And that's before he's paid a penny to his lawyers. But don't worry, all you suckers, and I'm going to call you suckers, writing checks to the Save America PAC, which is Trump's PAC, he's just using your hard-earned money to pay his lawyers. Because political campaigns, it's illegal for them to take political donations and pay lawyers and legal fees for the candidate. But a PAC can. Stop buying $5,000 pieces of Trump's suit and the gold sneakers. Stop it. And here's the even better news. Basically, every single person that's ever been affiliated with Donald Trump in a meaningful way and helped him commit these frauds is either ending up in jail or broke. I'm talking about you, Alex Jones, filing for bankruptcy. I'm talking about you, Rudy Giuliani, bankrupt, filing for bankruptcy, hit with nearly $200 million in fines for vilifying and lying about two Georgia state poll workers. MAGA-dominated parties, where the MAGA party loyals have taken over state and county party control from regular old Republicans, they're going broke. Arizona, nearly broke. Michigan, they've had two fistfights, nearly broke. Huge problems in Georgia. Everyone that lines up with Donald Trump ends up in jail or broke. He's stealing from you. He's stealing your heart, out of your pocketbook, and your soul. So all these people ending up getting lined up either to spend time in prison or with no shekels in their pocket any longer. Why would you want to be affiliated with someone like this? And he's not coming to anybody's rescue. He won't even show up for Rudy Giuliani and help him pay his legal fees. Rudy Giuliani's getting sued by the guy that was his right-hand man when Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. That's who he hired to be his lawyer in the criminal cases. And he didn't pay this guy, and that guy is suing him. To boot, Donald Trump's overall net worth is estimated to be about $2 billion, not the $10 billion he claims. So you want to talk about money judgments with interest running now in the hundreds of millions, tallying up? The civil justice system, where fines like this are meted out, works more slowly than the criminal justice system. And eventually, folks, the place that you hit people is in their pocketbooks. Don't let Donald Trump steal from yours. Keep that money in your pocketbook. If he's so rich, let him pay his own freight. The rest of us do. Maybe somebody should ask him what a gallon of milk costs, because I doubt he would know the answer. Now, here's what worries me most. If Donald Trump is indeed cash broke, where do you think he's going to get the money from? Might Putin come to mind? Might Saudi Arabia come to mind? That's what we should be worried about. That's going to be the true fraud on America. That's it for this episode of the Maggie Dawn Show. Tune in tomorrow, International Women's Day. I'm going to be joined by Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin. It's going to be a good one, folks. Thanks for listening. Stay safe out there. Channel 9 News, tell me I'm moving backwards.